The Brewers of Hyde Park, True Lager, the beer that's extra aged by Father Time, present Johnny Neblett in a dramatic presentation of So the Story Goes.
Tonight you'll hear the story of Paul Jordan Smith, who became famous because he laughed at art. You'll also hear the story of how 1 month and 11 miles meant the difference between success and failure and life and death.
In appreciation of your loyalty to Hyde Park True Lager, the beer that's extra aged by Father Time for extra flavor, the makers of Hyde Park invite you to spend a pleasant quarter hour with that well-known writer, narrator, and sports authority, Johnny Neblett. And friends, the makers of Hyde Park genuinely appreciate that loyalty you're showing. They're doing their level best to supply you with this grand beer wherever and whenever you want it, and with as much as you want, too. But you know what conditions are. And, well, if your dealer should be out of Hyde Park beer, or if he can't let you have as many bottles as you want, won't you please keep doing just what you are doing? Ask for it again next time. Shortages are only temporary. And when you do get Hyde Park, whether in the familiar 12-ounce bottle, the handy family-sized quart, or on tap, you'll get a really great beer with a downright satisfying flavor. Hyde Park. The beer that's seldom equaled, never excelled. And now here's Johnny Neblett, and So the Story Goes.
This is the story of a man who became an artist to ridicule art critics, but found his work was praised as being the work of a great genius of art. It all began when Paul Jordan Smith, a writer, came in from a game of golf one afternoon. His wife met him at the door, saying,
"Oh, Paul, I want to show you my newest painting. I just finished it. It's right over there, see?"
Yes, I see it there.
Well, don't you like it? What do you think of it, Paul?
May I ask, what's it supposed to be?
Oh, Paul.
Well, I'll admit it's better than some moderns, but those bright colors, they're awful.
Paul. But after all, you're not an art critic, dear. Besides, you probably couldn't do as well yourself.
Yeah, you just give me a canvas and some paint and I'll do better, even if I haven't studied art at all.
And so Paul Jordan Smith, a man who had never had an art lesson in his life, a man who had never tried to paint anything, took some tubes of paint, a worn brush, and a defective canvas, and in a matter of a couple of hours finished his first oil painting. It was a picture of a woman holding a banana high over her head, and Paul Jordan Smith called his work of art, "Yes, We Have No Bananas." He showed it to his family that night at the dinner table and laughingly thought that would be the end of it. But fate, that mysterious goddess that none of us can fathom or foretell, had other plans for this man who made fun of art. A few days later, a young man called at the Smith home. He was the art critic of the local newspaper. To the surprise of Paul Jordan Smith, he had this to say.
"I understand your family is in possession of a picture called, Yes, We Have No Bananas. If you don't mind, I'd like to have a look at it."
"Oh, I don't mind. It's right here in the hall. We haven't as yet found a place to hang it."
Very interesting. Extremely interesting. Shows real thought in creation, don't you think, Mr. Smith?"
"I think it's rotten."
"Yes, did you say rotten?"
"Absolutely rotten, my dear young man."
"Oh, Mr. Smith, I must differ with you. As a critic, I have this to say. I don't think one has a right to judge a work of art unless one knows what was in the soul of the artist."
And so Paul Jordan Smith decided that he would laugh at the world of art for a while. He changed the name of his picture to The Exaltation and took the fictitious name of Pavel Jordanovich as an added prop to his prestige. He bought a frame for that picture he had daubed in one afternoon and sent it to an exhibition. One morning, a few weeks later, he was able to read a letter from a world-famous critic who had seen the picture.
"Thought your painting called Exaltation most interesting. Shows new thought and new technique. Would be happy to have pictures of your other work and a short sketch of your life. Sincerely yours."
But the laughter of the artist did not drown out the praises of the critics. They wrote more letters to Pavel Jordanovich, begging him for his life story and pictures of his other works. Finally, to further the joke, he sent them a fictitious tale of his life, telling them that he'd been born abroad, starved in a garret, went to the South Seas for his health, and lived only for his art. The following year, he was invited to show his pictures in another world-famous exhibition. And for this event, he dashed off more pictures, all of them done with chuckles and laughter. He laughed all the harder when these pictures won high praise and comments. After still another exhibition, Pavel Jordanovich grew tired of this joke. People were saying that he'd started a new school of art. They began comparing his work to the great masters of art. Finally, Pavel Jordanovich revealed himself to the public as just plain Paul Jordan Smith, a man who had been merely fooling the art critics for the laugh. His story was printed in a metropolitan newspaper and reprinted in newspapers all over the country. But that didn't stop the critics. They still praised his work. They said that he'd discovered a new method of art. Paul Jordan Smith was the founder of the Disembracionist School of Art. The joke had gone too far to be stopped. And so the story goes. This story of how Paul Jordan Smith grew famous because he laughed at art. We today don't know what critics of the future might say about the work of Pavel Jordanovich, or, pardon me, Paul Jordan Smith. Perhaps he will go down in history as the greatest creative artist of our time. Such is the blind and illogical way of fame which forces attention on those who don't even seek it.
Fame forces attention on those who don't even seek it. You know, Johnny, that's a pretty good description of our waves and spars.
How so, Charlie?
Well, the waves and spars are red-blooded American women who have volunteered for a real wartime job. And though they don't expect any public recognition for it, the work they're doing is so important and so well done that their fame is spreading far and wide. But right now, more women are needed to enlist in the waves and spars to release more Navy men for active duty and fill the jobs they leave. That's why I'm asking you ladies in our audience, if you want to serve your country in a really essential job, a well-paid job, why not find out about the waves or spars right away? You can get complete information at the Naval Officer Procurement Office or the Navy Recruiting Office in your own community. Remember this, ladies. You are needed, and needed now, in the waves and spars. Why not find out more about these two services as soon as possible? It may be the wartime job you've been looking for. And now, here's Johnny Neblett and our second story.
A month is a relatively short time in the life of an average man, and 11 miles in these days of fast cars and even faster airplanes is no distance at all. Yet 1 month made the difference between success and failure. 11 miles made the difference between life and death in a fatal dash to that most desolate of all places, the South Pole. In 1901, a young British naval captain by the name of Robert Scott volunteered to lead an expedition to the Antarctic regions. It was not until 1910, however, that he'd raised enough money to equip the expedition. His ship left England and sailed through calm seas to Melbourne, Australia, where Scott received a cable giving him one of the greatest shocks of his life. The famous Norwegian explorer, Roald Amundsen, cabled him that he, too, was headed for the South Pole. Amundsen had originally set sail for the North Pole when news reached him that Admiral Parry had already reached the top of the world. Now he was determined to be the first man to reach the South Pole. But Scott, with true English fortitude, remained unperturbed at the news of this competition. He and his crew wanted near the fringe of Antarctica, making plans for the dash in the spring. And then on November 3rd, 1911, they were off. Off into that lonely expanse they went, where the temperature day after day may be 50 below, where the winds blow as high as 40 and 50 miles an hour. The group was large at first, but at intervals, they would establish food depots, and then some of the men would drop back. But misfortune dogged them from the start. Blizzards held them up, and then the ponies, which Scott had chosen to pull the sleighs, began to break through the drifts, floundering helplessly, and had to be destroyed. That meant that Scott and the remaining four men, Wilson, Bowers, Evans, and Oates, had to pull the sleighs, weighing almost 200 pounds for 9 long hours every day. Mile after mile they toiled, their faces blistered, their bodies weak and tired, until on January 4th, 1912, they reached 87 degrees south, the farthest south ever reached before by any man. This spurred them on to the goal ahead, but 14 days later, on January 18th, they saw to their horror as they peered ahead in the vast snow fields, the Norwegian flag waving at the South Pole. Yes, the Norwegians had been there before them. A note from Amundsen himself, lying in a tent on the very pole itself, said that his expedition had arrived there just about a month before. What an ironic trick of fate that Scott, who had been exploring the Antarctic for 10 years, should be beaten by a man who had no intention of going anywhere near the South Pole when he had set sail for Norway. If Parry had not discovered the North Pole when he did and thus turned Amundsen southward, Scott would most surely have been the first man to put his foot on the South Pole. And so, standing in the bitter cold, disappointed, Scott and his hardy crew were faced with 800 miles of ice and snow before they could get back to their main base. They averaged only 13 miles a day now. All of them were weak and sick, frostbitten, dejected. And then tragedy struck. Evans, the hardy little seaman, slipped and fell on the ice, causing a brain concussion. He lagged behind even the slow pace of the others now, falling on his knees, dragging himself along. And finally, he died in their arms. They buried him in a quiet little ravine. And then for 400 miles they carried on, dragging their heavy sleds behind them. It was 40 below zero now. Their food ration was short. But somehow they plodded on until finally they were only 60 miles from their last food depot. Home, their main base, lay just on the other side. And then Oates, who had been suffering terribly and who could hardly move, walked out one night into the raging blizzard to his death so that the others would not be held up. By now, the three remaining men were only making 3 or 4 miles a day. Scott's right foot had been frostbitten for some time. Their food was almost gone. They must get to the depot ahead. They quickened their pace as best they could. And then only 11 miles from the depot, a tremendous blizzard came up, driving them into their tents, keeping them there for 8 days while they grew weaker and weaker. Out of food, out of fuel, waiting, waiting for the storm to subside. But they were never to know if it did. 7 months later, a searching party came upon the snow-covered tent. Inside were the bodies of the three men who had so bravely met death. A great cairn of snow was built over the tent, and a cross put on top of that. And there Scott and his heroic men lie today, as unchanged as in the very moment when death came to them. And so the story goes, this story of Captain Robert Scott and his brave dash to the South Pole. Had Amundsen never heard of Parry's North Pole discovery and changed his mind, had Scott been able to leave on his trip a month earlier, he would most surely have been the first man to put his foot on the South Pole. But these are the pranks of fate that come to all men. Scott was a man of indomitable courage, a courage best expressed by the inscription to him still remaining on a great cross in the snowy vastness of the Antarctic.
To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
Well, friends, time's up for now, but we'll be back soon to tell you more of these true stories gleaned from the walks of life. Until then, this is Johnny Neblett reminding you 10% of your income invested in a United States war savings bond returns you 100% in victory.
You have just heard Johnny Neblett in another dramatic presentation of So the Story Goes. These quarter-hour visits with Johnny Neblett are presented for your enjoyment by the thousands of men and women who make and sell Hyde Park beer, the beer that's extra aged by Father Time for extra flavor. And now this is Charles Irving saying goodnight for the Hyde Park Breweries Association Incorporated of St. Louis, Missouri, makers of Hyde Park beer.